Are you craving incredible song recitals? Are you interested in a behind-the-scenes view into professional songmaking at the highest levels of artistry? Are you looking to develop your own artistic and entrepreneurial skills as a classical musician in this ever-changing 21st century landscape? If you found yourself saying yes to any of those questions, look no further than Cincinnati Song Initiative's week-long program, The Fellowship of the Song. Taking place this year from May 19 through 26, the Fellowship brings together some of the country's brightest song performers and teachers for a week of classes, concerts, and study events. And we invite you to join us as an auditor, either in person in Cincinnati or online wherever you may be located. When you join the Fellowship as an auditor, you gain instant access to the entire week's events and can go back and relive the magic through HD video recordings of each and every session. To learn more about this incredible new opportunity, visit CincinnatiSongInitiative.org/audit.
Okay, so should we just, I mean, unless there's any, unless you're going to ask me anything incredibly devious or personal, or I don't know, I can't really think of any questions you should warn me about, so it's better not to warn me at all.
I love this approach. It's very good. I don't think there will be anything that that will stump you in any way. If you have a funny or hilarious or ridiculous or embarrassing performance story, please share it for a little levity. But if not, you don't have to as well.
I've had many embarrassing performances. so I can have a think about that as we're chatting.
This is Song Cycle, where we gab with cool people who bring their innovative ideas and projects to life to contribute to a more vibrant society through song. I'm your host, Sam Martin, founding artistic director of Cincinnati Song Initiative. Let's get into it. Whether it's performers with amazing stories from the stage, entrepreneurs and administrators who work tirelessly to push our industry forward in exciting ways, composers with an eye toward the future of song, or anybody else in this big community, I want to hear from them and share their stories with you. Okay, everybody, welcome to this month's Song Cycle podcast episode. I'm incredibly excited to introduce our next guest, Ian Burnside. Thanks to prolific careers as a pianist and award-winning broadcaster, Ian is one of the UK's best-known musicians. He has worked with a huge number of international singers, notably Dame Margaret Price, Rosa Fiola, Eilish Tynan, Joyce DiDonato, Lawrence Brownlee, Roderick Williams, and Bryn Terfel, among many others. He has recorded more than 60 CDs, often created around neglected composers, where his curatorial skills are displayed to the full. He's a great champion of young singers, playing a crucial role in introducing them to a wider audience. This year has taken on an additional role as founding member of Trio Balthasar, alongside violinist Michael Foyle and cellist Tim Hugh. Innovative programming planning has led Ian to expand his concert work into a hybrid form of musical theater, creating staged works around pieces by Brahms, Wagner, and Gurney. He has broadcast extensively on both radio and TV, notably as host of BBC R3's acclaimed Voices series. In addition to a long association with London's Guildhall School, Ian is visiting international artist at the Royal Irish Academy of Music in Dublin. He is artistic director of the Ludlow English Song Weekend and artistic consultant to Grange Park Opera in Surrey. I don't know how we got him on this podcast. It is Ian Burnside. Thank you for joining me.
You don't want to believe everything you read in agent bios.
What an interesting career. Thank you for joining me. And I can't wait to get to know you better and learn more all about your incredibly diverse and unique career. But let's start with the basics, because some people have a sort of off the beaten path upbringing. Some people have a more traditional upbringing. What got you into music in general, and how did you end up on this path for song specifically?
Okay, those are two different things, really. Music generally was always kicking around in my family, and I always played the piano and was keen on the piano, and I studied music at university, then I specialized in piano at Royal Academy, and then I went to Warsaw, Poland, where I had 2 years. And I played a very, very few songs in the course of that. I was I was really doing mostly solo and instrumental chamber rep very happily. And I dipped my toe very, very cursorily in thing song. It just never really came up. I didn't hang out with singers and all that stuff. And then the extraordinary sequence of event which led me to becoming a song pianist or collaborative pianist and whatever term we like to use these days happened completely by chance, which was I was invited. I have an oboist friend from, I'm from Scotland, and our parents were friends together back in the war. And this oboist friend of mine, who's a contemporary, rang me up when I had finished studies and was, you know, playing any concerts I could and teaching untalented children to play the piano. And he rang up and he said, I've been asked to do a charity concert in the Britain Pier School in Aldborough. Would you like to come and play? And by the way, you have to play a solo piece in the middle to give me a little rest. So we went and did, he's a fantastic oboist, and we went and we did the concert, and I played a Schubert B-flat impromptu in the middle. And when we walked on and bowed, to my horror, I saw in the middle of the front row, Peter Pears. And I thought, ooh, better not mess this one up. Anyway, we did the concert, and then Peter came up at the end and was extremely charming and nice, and said, oh, the last person we heard play that Schubert was Clifford Curzon. And then he said that they were looking for pianists to play for song classes at the Britain Pier School. And did I know the Britain songs? And I couldn't at that point have named you one song by Benjamin Britten. I knew the theory they existed, but I couldn't tell you anything about them. But I was broke, and I knew the opportunity of a job going and didn't need poking twice. So I said, yes, yes, I adore the Britten songs. Yes, they're absolutely lovely. And then a few days later, I got a phone call saying we're fixing dates for me to go and play for some of Peter's classes. I went out and bought on this island and various other bits of Britain and learned them. And, you know, none of us come out of the womb knowing all this repertoire. You have to build it up gradually. So I did that. And that led to then playing for different residential masterclasses with amazing luminaries of the French and German repertoire and more for Peter. And that led me to meeting talented singers who then asked me to play for them in different contexts. And it just kind of went from there. I never sat down and said, this is what I want to be, this is what I want to do. I had some accompaniment lessons at the academy, which were very interesting and very nice. But again, that was as much instrumental as vocal. And so, you know, in retrospect, it does make perfect sense, because I'm very interested in languages and I'm interested in poetry. And once I started working with good singers, I just got it. And I thought, oh, I love this. And right. I love, you know, different voices and playing differently for different weights of voices and all that kind of stuff. So in retrospect, it does make perfect sense. But actually, at the time, it was a complete fluke.
Sure. Well, you know, those specific circumstances are, of course, unique to you. And what a funny story about, I mean, you called their bluff. but the
it's
idea
called lying.
Yes. Well, I mean, but the idea of sort of just falling into it, and one thing leads to another, and obviously you could get yourself around all the songs probably with complete ease, and it was just natural. And so the work kept coming. Did it just slip into turning into a passion for you? Or do you remember a pivotal point where it stopped so much being, you just were saying yes to the next gig and this is money and it's activity that I'm getting to say yes to? And it slipped into, oh, this is a real world that I'm opening into and I feel passionately about it. Was it an amorphous sort of shift into that world?
No, I think light bulbs came on. And also I can't say too strongly how big an influence it was working with some of these sort of great mentors. They weren't all great teachers or anything, but just being in the room with Hugues Queneau and Suzanne Donko and Hans Hotter and people like that, and just hearing their experiences. And Hugues Queneau took all the pianists out to dinner and told naughty stories and howled with laughter, and it just felt like becoming part of that world. And it was such a rich world, and And hearing Piers talk about Britain and stuff, it was a big experience. And it was a different context for my piano playing than I'd imagined. But, you know, it's not an either or necessarily. And but, you know, we're all tins of baked beans that are bought and sold. And you can only work in response to offers. You can play your little heart out in your studio on your piano, but if no one wants to hear it, it's not going anywhere. So you also have to be practical, and you know, careers are made out of the offers that we receive. And then, you know, a lot of us are lucky enough to be given some opportunities. And then the main thing is just don't mess it up. As an American friend of mine says, tried, tested, and failed is always better than untried. So
of course,
just, you know, hang in there is the big life lesson.
Yeah, for sure. Couldn't agree more. So do you have any specific favorite composers that come to mind to perform?
I do not have that luxury. I don't think of things in those terms, to be honest. No, I think, you know, most of my favorite composers that I'm playing at the time, I mean, how can you compare, you know, Fauré with Schubert, with, you know, Debussy? I mean, I love all the greats, all the obvious people. I mean, Schubert is kind of our patron saint. But again, so is Hugo Wolf. And then you've got the French guys and the American guys and the British guys and the Russian guy. I'm doing a lot of Russian music at the moment. And a lot of that is completely unknown to audiences and indeed to me. I've been working with a wonderful colleague who's got great whole archives of this stuff, of composers no one's ever heard of. And there's so much interesting stuff there and interesting poetry. And, you know, it's all out there. So... And I do love the underdog. As the mostly fictitious biog says, I have done a lot of recordings of people no one's terribly interested in, and you know, I've also recorded the three Schubert cycles with Roddy. Does the world need three more? No, not really. But they're there, and we did them, and it was wonderful. But you know, the Frauenliebe und Leben. Do we need another version of that? You know, whereas there are jewels waiting to be brought out into the light of day.
Yeah, 100%. Couldn't agree more. And it's sort of like a mind hole to think about everything that's out there and to work to not continue to be trapped thinking that just because certain composers and certain songs are the best well-known and continue to be cycloned into being the most studied, that they're inherently the best pieces of music necessarily.
I couldn't agree more. And this actually leads us to a little conundrum of those of us who work as teachers in this field. Because if you're working with young pianists and young singers, they kind of do have to know their way around some of Schubert Volume 1 and some of the top hits.
Of course.
At the same time, you want to open their eyes to volumes 2 to 7 or however many there are, you know, and that is a dilemma. I mean, lots of people sing Gretchen am Spinnrad who really shouldn't, but it's important for young pianists to kind of know how it goes and what the issues are. So
100%. And I'll add on to that, even within, you know, expanding from Schubert Volume 1 to Schubert's Volume 2 through 7. I mean, at least in this country, we're undergoing a huge renaissance of literally pulling out and adding leaves to the dining room table. And there's a lot of effort by a lot of people being put into sort of even identifying brand new names of composers that people haven't heard of. A lot of sort of historically underrepresented groups and people that maybe we knew were out there, but no one's bothered to put in, you know, more than half an ounce of work to explore their songs. And
also, it's never been easier to access music, both scores and recordings. And I mean,
and living composers, indeed. Personally.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's all out there.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. I'm with you. It's really hard to nail down a favorite composer. I'm like you. I find my favorite composer is whoever I'm working on, but also the most distant composer that has been the furthest in the past of who I've performed lately, and then I need to cycle back to revisiting some of their songs. They're also my favorite. So very good, very good. So tell us about, in the biography, it mentioned they staged music theater pieces, you know, works by Brahms, Wagner, Gurney. How did those come about? And is there a specific story with one or all of them that you can share about what it was like and how you got into that?
How long have you got? Well, this all started, my mothership in terms of institutions is the Guildhall School, where I've worked for several decades in different capacities. And at one point, the previous principal is a wonderful man called Barry Ife. And he at one point took me aside. I was sort of changing my role there. And he took me aside and said, look, what is it you'd really like to do? And I said, well, what I'd really like to do is, I find so many song recitals incredibly boring. I'd like to see if we can't do something about that and just try some different things. And he found a little bit of money down the side of a sofa and said, get on with it. And so that was the most wonderful liberation. And so I've done a whole range of different things, actually. From straightforward songs mixed in with poems. We've done portraits of Dickinson, of Whitman, of Thomas Hardy, different things like that, which basically look like concerts. But then we've also done various more staged things. The Brahms thing is called Shining Armor, and that was a piece. It was voice, piano, and one actress. And so it's not staged in the sense of, you know, costumes or anything, but it is a complete performance of Brahms's cycle Die Schöne Magalone, which is a crazy piece, and where you need to tell the story of what happens between the songs, which is a very silly story. Otherwise, you don't understand what it's about. And so the conceit I have is that the story is being told as you go along, but it's being told by Clara Schumann, and she also sheds light on how those songs relate to her situation with the much younger, then dashing, handsome, and blonde Johannes Brahms, which is, of course, incredibly well-trodden path, the whole Robert, Clara Johannes triangle, but that is my little take on it. And the actress that's done it also works at the Guildhall as someone who's a dear colleague who did it marvelously. So that was the Brahms thing. The Wagner thing also looks like a concert, and that has got two singers and an actor, and it's about the relationship between Wagner and the Wesendonks. And the mezzo-soprano plays Mathilde Wesendonck, the bass plays Otto Wesendonck, and the actress, Victoria, plays the much put upon Minna Wagner, Wagner's first wife. And actually, it's really kind of about Minna, because I found her role in this interesting. And this recent work has been done on the Wesendonck's and Wagner's time in Zurich, which has revealed all sorts of interesting and rather murky and rather dark things. And by the wonders of the internet, I basically pinched most of this from this new book called Wagner in Zurich, a new age, you know, sort of 5 years ago. And as I was writing it, I thought, oh God, I hope this guy who wrote it, I hope he never hears about this, because he's going to sue me, or, you know, whatever. So it was basically a dramatized version of what he'd written. And then out of the blue, I got an email from this man saying, oh my God, I've just seen your piece and I loved it. He was so encouraging. He was so nice. And I said, I was terrified that you were going to be angry because I probably got bits wrong and because I, you know, it's all your idea. And he said, no, I was just so delighted that anyone read my book so carefully. So that story had a happy ending. But to answer your original questions, the biggest dramatic thing I did was I actually ended up writing a play about Ivor Gurney, which went through various iterations, but in the end ended up being called A Soldier and a Maker, which was fully staged and had an actor playing Ivor and a cast of, I think, 23 student singers and pianists, all in World War One costumes and nurses' costumes.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, and we did this in the small theater in the Barbican Center, and it was a big thing to do. And I can't thank the Guildhall enough for, I mean, I'm completely unqualified as a playwright and unqualified as a director, but we somehow cobbled together both roles. And it started off being a program where I don't know how much you know about Gurney, but you know, the story of his life is very sad and very tragic, but actually mm-hmm. a very funny guy. And even when he was in the trenches fighting in the war with mental health issues, he wrote right. very witty letters as well. He was equally renowned as a poet and composer. So mm-hmm. I was originally just going to do a straightforward poem, letter, song, poem, letter, song type thing. And as right. I was doing that, I thought this is really boring. And I started writing a few little links. And then I wrote a few more links and I thought, no, it's still really boring. And then I thought, oh God, I'm writing a play. Don't think about it, just do it. And then so it kind of limped forward. And so we did that and everyone had a good time.
How fascinating that feeling of just letting go and doing it when you realize you're writing the play. It's just like when you start down a ski hill. I don't know if you've ever skied.
I'm not a skier, but you know, it's like renovating a house or anything like that. You only learn how to do it by doing it.
And
if it turns out you're terrible at it, well, other people have been terrible at it before you too, so don't worry too much. And you know, yeah. People are still dying in Gaza or in Syria or wherever. I mean, if it doesn't
exactly
happen, it's not the end of the world. Enjoy it, have a shot, you know.
Exactly. And people are more than happy to forget, you know, bad experiences if it all falls on its face. So I tell this to other people all the time. No one is, you know, lying awake in the dead of night thinking about someone else and their failures. Everybody's just worried about themselves.
Well, and the other, just to continue my hymn of praise to the erstwhile Guildhall principal, he had the wisdom to allow me to do most of these things twice, because I said, look, you've got to do it once to find out what's wrong with it, and then you fix it. And it's very liberating working with music theatre people, because unlike opera people, when someone writes a modern opera, in most cases, that's it. You put it on stage and you do it, and it either works or it doesn't. In the music theatre, they're much more pragmatic, and they'll do previews and things, and they'll say, oh, no, that's too long there, and oh, we need another number there, and that number doesn't really work, or it's quite nice, but don't put it there. They're much defter at
workshopping
test pieces. Yeah. And there's so much to be said for that. And you can only tell with, or I mean, I don't have the experience to just do it just from the printed page and know what's going to work and what's not. So the whole workshop element is very important. And I think it's very important to be able to react to that.
Yeah.
But then it's the same with concert programming. You know, you only learn what works by doing it. And then suddenly you think, oh God, the interval should have been 10 minutes ago, or there shouldn't be an interval, more to the point.
Right. Yeah.
And so on and so forth. So I'm a pragmatist with all of that. If it doesn't, chuck it out.
Yeah, 100%. It sounds great. Well, so speaking of the Guildhall School, they need to hire you as their PR spokesperson and prime marketing agent. That's what they need to do. Tell me a little bit about, as a teacher, what is an intention that you find yourself keeping in relation to your students? Is there something that you really hone in that you find that you have sort of an undulating theme, no matter who your student is, that you hone in on and make sure that you work with them on? Or is there an intention that you keep in your teaching?
One recurring theme that a question I end up asking a lot of them is, is that what you want me to hear? Show me what you want me to hear.
Hmm.
And at the moment I'm hearing that, are you happy with that? Is that what you want me to hear? And what about that bit in the left hand? Do you want me to hear that? Because if you do, then you're going to have to play the right hand down a bit. That kind of thing. So I'm interested in layering sound, having different levels of sound, foreground, middle ground, background, if you like.
Yeah.
Is a handy rule of thumb. That's one thing. And I've just done a project here, actually. And one of the things we did a lot of with not particularly experienced accompanists, and one of the things that I was trying to get them to see was that a lot of them were playing the repertoire with great attention, admirable, commendable attention to the composer's written intentions in the score. But my angle with them is, that's great, but it's a starting point. And now you have to relate those dynamics to what your singer is doing. Because if you're playing for singer X with a generous voice, her piano, the amount of sound she's making for that piano phrase, you are going to answer that on the piano with that melodic phrase. And at the moment, I can't hear you. and right. you have to balance to her. So it's her piano is different from what you're thinking of in your world. It's all just a question of listening, and it's all chamber music in the end. It's all about listening and adapting. And some students find that easier to do than others. And a lot of it's experience and having, you know, it's like what the pilots have, flying miles, you know, where they have to do a certain number of hours in the cockpit. Yeah. A lot of it's that. And you just have to do lots of different music. Going back to my early days, one of the ways I was unintentionally very well trained was doing a great diversity of repertoire and having different people say too loud, too soft, too slow, too fast. And just doing lots of that is such a good education. And and then not being married to your version. And, you know.
That's a great point.
Well, it's an underlying truth of all education, not just music education, that a huge part of talent is the ability to change and, yeah. and murder your babies and don't hang on to things, you know, and see if it works. And if there's another way of doing it better, then embrace that and upwards and onwards.
That's great. So what is your advice to eager young singers and pianists who hope to move into a fulfilling career in song and concert work in today's day and age?
I just did an interview with a piano magazine and they asked me the same question. And I'm afraid I said, my advice to the pianists is become conductors. there are two different levels to answer this on. You know, we have all these courses turning out collaborative pianists, and what are they all going to do? That is something that keeps me awake at night. That is something that keeps me awake at night, because if you look at the supply and demand, the statistics are not great, okay?
Right.
And right. I think maybe this is something we can just park in the corner and come back to, but I mean, I think the generation of our current conservatoire students are going to have to do a lot of reinventing of the wheel to sustain this as an art form and to find ways in which it's not boring and not visually dreary and can reinvigorate it. But for those, so I see my role as initially discouraging of singers and pianists who want to do it by telling them all the pitfalls and why they shouldn't do it. And then of course, supporting them to the max if they decide they really do want to do it. I mean, I think to separate the singers and pianists just briefly,
yeah.
And even talking about duos are great, but you know, outside in the big wide world, there aren't that many duos. I mean, it's interesting you're talking to Roddy in your next podcast. I mean, yeah. Roddy is quite promiscuous with the number of pianists he works with, but then I'm promiscuous with the number of singers I work with.
Right.
There's a lot to be said for that, and yeah. for it not to become too marital.
Right.
Because as with in many marriages, then I think each can get in the other's nerves. So it's very good to work for a block and then to work with other people. So singers, I think the thing is, most singers want to be opera singers, and that's great. But if they can have song going in parallel with that and find mm-hmm. ways of painting in watercolors as well as bright acrylic paint, then mm-hmm. they will benefit greatly in terms of vocal finesse, in terms of development as artists. And they'll also have more fun. And in opera, you're cast by casting directors, by conductors, by stage directors. And usually that's very related to your physique and your age and your look. And it's not a decision you mostly make until you're on a high echelon. You are a commodity being bought and sold. If you're asked to do a song recital, you get to choose. Hey,
exactly.
That's the fun bit. And yeah. if you're a high soprano, you don't have to sing songs about nightingales the whole time. You can sing lots of songs about death and do things that you're never going to sing about if you're singing Susanna or whatever.
Right.
And if you're a bass, you don't have to just sing about death. You can sing songs about nightingales if that's what you want to do.
Exactly.
For pianists, there's a bit of that too. It's a different train set to play with. And my advice for pianists is learn as many languages as you can. You don't have to be fluent in them, but don't be afraid of them. Embrace mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. Watch Netflix series in Italian, German, and French. Find fun ways of engaging with the language so you're not intimidated by it, but so you get the sound in your head. And then next stage, watch the same Netflix series but not with English surtitles, with French surtitles.
Yes.
And so on and so forth. You know, but make it fun, enjoy it, and be part of the singers' lives in that sense too, and explore with them. But, you know, the real challenge is, well, the interesting thing is why so many pianists become entrepreneurial figures and end up, I mean, we have, I mean, in Britain, we have we've got far too many good people here. Well, you should be exporting them. We've got far too many good people who have their own festivals or their own concert series or whatever. And we're all clambering over one another to work and be happy and all those things. The young ones, so you're going to have to find a way of generating work and generating imaginative projects that satisfy them, but also that concert promoters might take a look at and say, yeah, that's a lovely idea. Why don't we put that on? And that could be putting on in a little obscure church in Lower Wallopsville, or it could be in a major concert series. And another bit of advice for the young starting out, don't be too proud. I mean, don't worry about being paid lots. Just do it. If you get a chance, if you get a village hall, if you get a parish church down the road with a piano in it, offer them a lovely series of four concerts with your best friends, with your dog, with your auntie. Take them along and just do it. Because out of nothing will come nothing. So just get out there, and you never know who's going to come to the concert, and one thing can lead to another.
Yeah. It's great advice, and it's good to hear from someone, you know, of your stature and level of experience, because it's so true. It's easy to get bogged down by the common wisdom of, you know, if it's not a significant pay, why is it worth my time or anything? And it's balanced with that, you know, adage of like, you know, we're taught to rally against, at least in America, you know, taking opportunities for, quote, the exposure, right? You know, we're taught to be allergic to that because everything has a monetary value attached to it. But, you know, there's a balance that needs to be struck, because the hard, cold truth, to your point, is, you know, nothing ventured, nothing gained. If you just say no to everything because it's not the fanciest gig in the world, no one will ever get to know you. No one owes anybody anything. That's the hard truth.
I'm completely with you on all of that. I couldn't agree more. And there's another point here, which is important, which is specific to the recital world. If you're a singer, the first thing that needs to be said is singing solo recitals is extremely demanding, and it's extremely difficult. And it takes a lot of work and a lot of preparation, particularly if you're going to memorize everything.
Right.
And there can be scary places. That the crook of the piano can be a very scary place to be. They're particularly scary if you set off and have a marvelous opera career and think, yeah, I'm going to do all my opera career and make lots of money and become famous, and then I'm going to do a recital tour of the USA or whatever. It's if you haven't done recitals since you were 19, and then you're famous and 35 or 40, and you think, right, oh, I think I'll do Schönemüllerin now. Good luck.
No.
Because it doesn't work that way. Recitals are only fun if you do lots of them. And if you can really just, it's a muscle, if you're not afraid of it, and I completely respect the singers who are, by the way, it's not for everybody.
Right, right.
And of course, there are recitals and recitals. And I mean, I'm about to go into a recital. The next concert I'm doing with a wonderful Italian soprano, who you name-checked actually in that rather embarrassing roll call, includes those well-known leader, The Fountain Scene from Lucia di Lammermoor, Belraggio Lusinghiere, Air de Lia of Debussy. I mean, there's whole wadges that are operatic and you know, orchestral repertoire. That's fine. It's somewhere who it's in a European opera house, and that's what they want. That's what they like. It's just a different sort of recital from the traditional Lieder Abend. So yeah, the key is to do lots. So the little unpaid gig at your local church, it may seem not worth your while financially, and it may well not be, but as a prelude to a more important concert, or just to get new rep under your belt and a first pass at something, it's beyond price. It's invaluable.
Yeah. It needs to be viewed as an investment.
That's a very perfect way of looking at it. And then if you do, let's say you do that concert and you've got five different groups of five different composers, you might find that the Fauré group went better than the Schubert group. Well, then drop the Schubert group from the next one, or make it a bigger Schubert group and approach it from a different angle. But you need to be working with those building blocks, and it's all about experience, and then you can move the locks in different directions.
Such good advice. It's so helpful to zoom out and look at it from those different angles than just, you know, what is the dollar figure attached to this opportunity, you know?
Well, if dollar figures are what you're after, go to law school. I mean,
you yeah, 100%.
For this, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. 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 Okay.
Or become a conductor.
Oh, full circle.
We need conductors more than we need song pianists. I'm sorry. There are more jobs for them. They get better paid. They don't have to be any good. No one cares if the conductor is crap.
Yes. Just go wave your hands.
Yeah. Yeah. You have to play scales in the morning.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, all right. So, okay, let's wrap it up. Do you have like an embarrassing or ridiculous or a funny performance story you would be willing to share with us that wouldn't re-traumatize you as you're telling it?
I play now almost entirely from the iPad, and I have had every possible form of iPad malfunction and misunderstanding. And
it's harrowing. I just performed from it on Wednesday night, and I have a pedal to change the page.
Yeah.
It's scary.
But do you use the pedal with your foot?
I use the pedal with my foot. And you know how I got good at that? In COVID, I was on the music staff at Rice University in Houston, and we stayed in person. All the pianists got iPads because we weren't allowed to transmit physical music copies between singer and pianist. And so it was come hell or high water. And I had a year of playing, you know, 12, 13 concerts in a year, and I got that.
You got it done. Well, I hate using the foot pedal because it reminds me of my unhappy organ playing past. And so I had a hot tip from my friend and colleague James Baillieu, who said, no, just use a page turner, but give them the foot pedal. And this is the answer to all your prayers. They can just hold it and go click. And it's marvelous. And you don't have them doing that. You don't have their arm
right
in your nose. You don't have their swatch watch audible as they lean over, and they don't pull the music off. It's really a brilliant solution. However, things can still go wrong, and batteries can go low, or the connection between the two stop. And then I found out, I doing a live stream at Wigmore Hall in COVID, I did a Winterizer with a bunch of different singers. And I thought I did already various things go wrong with the iPad. And I thought I thought I'm good to just cover every bass and make sure everything works brilliantly. And I put it all on well in advance, and it was all ready to go. Come on to do it. I was using that with my foot actually. And what I didn't realize was that there was a time limit thing where it just switched itself off.
Are you serious?
So I start playing and then go click and nothing happens. And you know, your heartbeat just does terrible things when that happens. And all it needed to do was switch off and on. And about song four, I suddenly realized, having done this madly and poked it, I suddenly realized what had happened and I worked it out. And then it's all fine. But I've had every form of malfunction. No, but going back to page turning, of course, page turners are the bane of all our lives. And it's a horrible job, and everyone knows that. But I did some concerts in Japan once, and there were two page turners. So one was a page turner fell off the stage because she put the turner back and she tipped over. There was an adorable different occasion where the page turner got up and prepared well in advance everything I'd asked them to do. I explained how I liked it to work. Be standing by the beginning of the last line, and I'll nod. So she got ready, and I nodded. But being Japanese and beautifully mannered, after I nodded to her, she stopped and nodded to me. nodded back. By which time I was halfway through the next page, so I had to calculate the nod time. So it was sort of a line sooner than I would. So we had to, and she was so touching. She was doing it so sweetly that you couldn't be cross or anything because it was.
So you nodded to her, she nodded back to you, and then what? Back. You nodded again, and she did it.
It was a two nations, different language situation.
Yes, brings a whole new meaning to a song and dance routine.
There you go.
That's amazing. I'm only laughing about the person falling off the stage with the assumption that they were okay, right?
Yeah. It was a little alarming, but no bones were broken.
Gosh, that's alarming. Woo. Okay, well, those are some pretty good stories. My heart is beating just for you thinking about that all happening. So well done for surviving.
So I want you to try the Page Turner pedal app compromise, and I think your life will be changed. Because it's also much nicer for the Page Turner because it's instant. Turning that way is not instant. And as we know, right. There are some people who turn at that speed and others yep. who rip the page off. And yep. there's all of that going on. Whereas here, it's instant. You just go click. It's marvelous.
I will try it. It will force me to be more disciplined. I'm a procrastinator about organizing last minute logistics for a concert, like getting a page turner and like creating the translations for a program or anything. I'm a huge procrastinator about that stuff. And so for the Bluetooth page turn pedal thing has been a godsend to me because I don't have to email people and beg them.
But you need both feet to play the piano. What happens if
I know it's rough.
The corridor?
It's rough. I think maybe that is worth trying out. Well, any last tidbits? This has been a delightful almost hour. Oh, tell everybody about Ludlow, please.
Oh, well, Ludlow, I do a micro festival, which goes from Friday evening to Sunday afternoon in a beautiful town in Shropshire, England, called Ludlow, far from any city. It's absolutely gorgeous and it's lovely. And we have two beautiful performing venues, a magnificent church and Georgian assembly rooms. And everything is a 2-minute walk away and it's a beautiful market square. And this is devoted, it's called the English Song Weekend. Well, I'm Scottish, so I'm the last person to be waving an English flag, but it's English in the broadest sense. For example, we're doing a South African piece this year for baritone, double bass and piano, setting some amazing South African poetry. Yeah, and we try and balance A.E. Housman, the poet. A.E. Housman is buried in the churchyard, and he wrote these poems called A Shropshire Lad, and we're in Shropshire, and so we favour a lot of that side of the song repertoire, but also have a lot of new work, commissions.
Yeah,
we're diverse, and we don't want it to become kind of Brexity and nationalistic in the wrong way, but it's an opportunity to lift some stones and see what song repertoire lies underneath. And we've made some remarkable discoveries, including this year, just if I've got time to just tell one little story. In the course of the calendar year, I get lots of emails from people saying, oh, why don't you do this? Or why don't you do that? Or can I have a concert? Please give me a job.
Right,
and
right.
Variations on that theme. And I got an email completely out of the blue from an elderly gentleman who said, could he send me a manila envelope with some scores in it? Which he did. And they were very interesting. And this is a composer called Jessie Reason. It's her married name. And this gentleman who sent me them had been killing time before a concert in, I think, Birmingham or Manchester, one of the cities north of London. And he and his wife popped into a secondhand bookshop and found lying on a shelf reams of manuscripts in faint pen by a woman they'd never heard of. And they bought it for incredibly little money.
Of course.
And back the next day with two suitcases. And they filled two suitcases of this.
Oh my God.
And it's the most extraordinary story of a woman who at one point in her life took composition very seriously and was encouraged by the composer Eugene Goossens, but then got married and had a family and became a suburban mum. And this music has somehow made its way onto one of our concert programs through a series of happenstance things. And but I find that rather wonderful. And then everyone can say if they think it's any good or not. So we're doing three settings of the poet Rabindranath Tagore with a rather unappealing title, Songs of Death. But we won't dwell on that bit. And we're doing editorial work. We're trying to work out, is that a G sharp or G natural? And, you know, that's all the fun of the fair. So I'm sad enough that gets me excited. So.
Well, let's just hope you get a healthy, wonderful audience to enjoy it with you.
I know we have a wonderful audience. People come for the whole weekend and make the whole thing of it. And you are all invited. Please, all your friends. And we pride ourselves on being the friendliest festival there is.
Ooh, the gauntlet is thrown.
Well, and you end up, the, you end up in the pub with the singer and the pianist and everyone's friends, and it's extremely sociable. And we have film and we have discussions and masterclasses, and we cram a lot in, and it's great.
It sounds delightful. I'm imagining we need to get a podcast episode and line up all y'all over there.
Oh, yes.
Run a festival. We need to have like a big group meeting and have everybody, you know.
That's not a crazy idea.
Throw down. It could be fun. And you all over there are so inspirational. Cincinnati Song Initiative is launching its first ever Fellowship of the Song Week in May. So everybody can come to Shropshire and Ludlow and in April, and then to May to Cincinnati. We're launching our first week-long Fellowship Festival Week, which
that's wonderful. And what's going to be in the week?
We have ours is centered around, we've invited 5 singers and 5 pianists through international auditions, and they participate in daily masterclasses, and they have 2 concerts during the week. But to fill it out, and they coach and things like that, and it's all led by Margot Garrett. And additionally, for all auditors and spectators, there's classes each day. There's study events. There's other concerts that are going to be added in addition to the fellows concerts. So it's the germ, it's the kernel of what we hope to be quite a robust week-long festival.
That's wonderful. And you hope to do it annually?
We hope to do it annually, and everybody over in England, you are all such huge inspirations to us, and we're trying to crank up the old machine over here in America.
Well, that's great.
Thank you, Ian Burnside, for speaking with me, and we look forward to next month's episode with Roderick Williams, who you referenced and name-dropped, and you guys perform all the time. I was lucky enough to see you perform in Oxford last October. Incredible performance, and we'll speak with Roddy next month. But thank you, Ian, for joining me.
Thank you so much.
What was your favorite part about this episode? Let me know when you rate, review, and subscribe this podcast. It's the best way to help the show reach other song lovers, and isn't that what it's all about? Catch new episodes of Song Cycle every 4th Thursday of the month wherever you podcast. Song Cycle is a production of Cincinnati Song Initiative. You can learn more about its network of podcasts at cincinnatisonginitiative.org/podcasts.
That's all for now, songsters. We'll see you next time.